Okay, today is Monday, June 24th, the 16th of Tammuz. And just to let you know, tomorrow, or really today, because the day starts in the night, I said it was the 16th of Tammuz, but really, it's just about the 17th of Tammuz. So just to let you know, today is a traditional fast day, 7th day of Tammuz, 17th of Tammuz. And it begins before the beginning of light in the sky in the morning, tomorrow morning, and ends with three stars. And so traditionally the practice is no food or water during the day tomorrow. Not tonight, but during the day tomorrow. Some people get up early, like the Muslims do during Ramadan, and eat before the sun comes up. And if you weren't planning on doing that, or you don't feel like you can do that, but you do want to participate in some way, you know, there's ways you can do partial fasts. Some examples would be, one way would be to eat a reduced amount of, and a reduced kind also, like for example, just raw fruits and vegetables, not eat any cooked grains or animal products has somewhat of a fasting effect. And of course you can go more, you can go just maybe drink, just water, just juice. Another way that you can do it is you can do it for a complete fast, no food or water, but don't do it for the whole day. You know, you can go for part of the day, and so that you can actually get the experience of some fasting when you skip a meal. And then say, okay, I'm going to do it till noon, or I'm going to do it till, I think it's one something is actually technically the middle of the day, maybe 1:11 or one something. Anyway. So I want to tell a little story that's, it's very funny, but it's also like heartbreaking, not in a tragic way, just in a, you'll see, kind of way.
yes. What it's a fast day for?
Oh, fast day for.
Why is it?
Yeah. Well, it's one. Actually, Reb Svi, do you remember exactly what it's for?
Well, I asked Rabbi Sarah Graf actually in Shul on Shabbos at Kolomet. So, I think the primary mourning, the thing that we mourn on that fast, is fasting is usually about mourning a loss. Is that the Romans, or was it the Babylonians, breached the walls of the temple on their way to destroying the temple and destroying Jerusalem. So I was thinking it was commemorating the Romans or the Babylonians, the first or the second temple.
Right.
There's another one that I learned also from Rabbi Graf, which is that it commemorates the day on which the children of Israel dance around the golden calf. And evidently there's a bunch of other not such wonderful things that happen on the 17th. But also, Rev. Brian, I was wondering, is this the kind of fast day that if you study a piece of Mishnah, then you can have a meal of joy as Sudat Mitzvah to break the fast, or it's not one of those?
I'm pretty sure not. You know, I'm not an expert, and we can all look up on Chabad.org tonight. And we can find,
there you go.
We can find all the answers to our questions. What Reb Svi is referring to is that there are certain fasts where you can not do the fast by having a suda mitzvah, which is a meal. Suda is a meal, and a meal that's a mitzvah, meaning it's a commandment, a spiritual practice to do the meal, and there's certain conditions under which that happens. So the classic one for that is leading into Pesach, the day that leads into the night of Pesach. Traditionally is the fast of the firstborn, and traditional synagogues will have a suda mitzvah that will celebrate the completion of studying something, usually a tractate of Gemara, of Talmud, a whole section. They'll time it so they end on that day, and then all the firstborn people can come and participate in that, and they don't have to fast on the day before getting ready for the Seder and everything. man, I can't. It doesn't seem like a good time to fast, and the rabbis must have known that and instituted that. But as far as I know, the 17th of Tammuz is one of those one of the five fast days in Judaism that's for everybody, that you don't avoid unless you medically have to or something. So anyway, back to the story. And actually, this is all what you said about the golden calf and all these different holidays in Judaism tend to accrue more and more meaning as time goes on, because more historical things tend to get attributed to that date to build on whatever the tone of the day is. And this is a day of mourning, so it's a time of remembrance of loss and destruction, and it also begins a 3-week period of that. So starting tonight and going for 3 weeks is generally has a tone of sadness to it, and culminates with the 9th of Av, which is another fast day, which is the only other complete fast day like Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur meaning you start at sundown and it goes until three stars the next day. And Tisha B'Av, 9th of Av, is the only other one that's like that. So, and then after that, the tone changes, the sun starts to come out, you know, and then we get to the holiday of love, which is Tu B'Av, the 15th of Av, a few days later. But I digress. So just a little educational stuff just to know about. You can always, of course, research this more if you want to know more. But this golden calf issue is going to be relevant. So my family is away for a month now, and I'm going to visit them in the middle, but right now they're in Florida. And Lisa's father, who my son Adan calls Poppy Normie, took him somewhere today, and there was thunderstorms and thunder and lightning. And as you know, here in the Bay Area, we don't have so much thunder and lightning, you know. So it's like, I mean, I grew up with it in New York. I remember being terrified when I was 2-3 years old, like, you know. But he hasn't experienced it that much. And he's 7 years old. But it happened, and he was kind of freaked out. And I heard this story from Lisa, who heard it from her father, that they were together, but they were in a public place. They were out somewhere, maybe some kind of, I don't know, amusement park or something. And the thunder and lightning start happening, and Adam is scared, but then he suddenly got this urgency, and he started running around to the other people that were all around, and he started finding anyone with a red shirt and saying, you gotta save yourself. You're gonna, you know, you might get struck by lightning, you're wearing a red shirt. And he's running around to all the people with red shirts to tell them, you're in great danger. You have to, please, you have a red shirt. Please go find cover, you know, go. And apparently, you know, I mean, I didn't get the full picture how this was unfolding, but it seemed like Lisa's dad was just kind of didn't know what was going on. It was like puzzled, like, why, what is he doing? Why is he? And he didn't really, you know, ask Adan at the moment. But later, when they came home, he told the story to Lisa. And Lisa's like, Adan, what's up with that? Why are you concerned about people with red shirts? So it turns out that Lisa had said something to him a long time ago about the guys in Star Trek with red shirts who always get killed. And we had seen, there was a Star Trek episode on where they went down to a planet. And they went on some planet, and a lightning came and struck a guy with a red shirt, and he just turned into, you know, he was like, he vanished. He turned into fire and smoke. And Lisa said something like, oh, the red shirt guy got it, you know, something like that. And Adan internalized, he thought that it was dangerous to have a red shirt on in the lightning. And then when he realized, she said, no, you misunderstood. And like, he suddenly realized, and he got really embarrassed and didn't want to talk about it, and kind of, you know, withdrew a little bit, and you know, was just feeling really embarrassed. So, why do I bring it up? Because we all tend to have this erroneous fear. You know, like the red shirt fear, you know, like, uh-oh, you have a red shirt, you're going to die. You know, it's like, it's not a true fear. But the fear is that we are afraid of experiencing certain things. We're afraid of having certain kinds of feelings. And because of that fear, there's a contraction on the inside away from the feeling. Even it might not even be the feeling itself. It might just be the fear of having a certain feeling because of something that might happen. And we might not even articulate it to ourselves that we're afraid of having the feeling. We might think, I'm afraid of that external thing, right? But in reality, we're afraid of the external thing only because we're afraid that that external thing is going to give us a certain experience. And we're afraid of having certain experiences. And so that creates a knot of contraction, whether it's a knot of worry or concern or even it could go into any of the four directions that we've talked about. The first one being negativity, anger. If we resent an experience coming to us, if we're resentful of it and we feel like indignant about it, then that's going to create some kind of anger. We're unwilling to just be having the experience we're having, so we're angry at it. Angry at maybe projected on a person or whatever. We're angry that we have to endure this experience. Or we are longing for something to make this experience better because this isn't enough. This experience I'm having now, it's not that it's bothering me, but it's not enough, right? It's not fulfilling me. It's not giving me what I need. And so I'm longing for something else. And so therefore, I'm not present. I'm not open. I'm in a knot about needing something, right? That's number two. Number three is, it's not negative about what I'm experiencing and it's not needing something different, but it's rather resistance to what I have to do, right? I need to do something. I'm called to act and for whatever reason, but I resist doing that. I resist having to expend energy. I'd rather just be sitting here. I'd rather go to bed. I'd rather whatever. I can't get up and make myself do what I need to do. So that's number three. And then number four is could sometimes come from a fear of vulnerability, a fear of whatever's going to come up if I actually let myself feel, if I actually let myself be open. And so therefore, what do? I cover it all over with stuff, with noise, you know, with whatever kind of noise I can put on there. You know, like I saw some friends of mine play at the Starry Plow last Saturday night after Shabbat. And I was just amazed, like they were playing really, really amazing music, incredibly talented people. But it's a bar, you know, so there's this general noise always going on. And there was a lot of people actually sitting right in front of the stage, like completely attentive, really just wanting to completely listen to what was going on. Mm-hmm. But the rest of the bar was just buzzing with, you know? And that's, as a musician, if you play in that context, that's what you expect. You know that's there. And they weren't upset about it. They didn't let it bother them. They just were talking to the audience and whatever. But it was definitely not a space that could fully receive the impact of what they were doing because it was way too much buzz, way too much. So that's why meditation is so important and powerful, not just in and of itself, but also as a to positively impact how we relate with anything, and especially with prayer. How can we possibly get to the depth of our heart to express itself in prayer if we're all noisy, right? It's kind of obvious, right? So we have to first be able to be with whatever it is that's going on and be receptive to it. So, but we have this fear that results in this inner contraction of experiencing certain things. But it's erroneous. You know, it's like the guys getting struck by lightning in their red shirts. It's not real. Same thing. we can't be hurt by any experience. Doesn't mean experience can't be painful. We can have very painful experiences. But past the painfulness of the experience, the way we get hurt by our experiences is by continuing to hold them as a knot in ourselves, either after they happen or in resisting that they're going to happen. But all the different flavors of experience and all the different types of emotional pain that we can experience is not as damaging as simply as the knot that we tend to contract into because we don't want to feel it, because it feels bad. It makes sense. We don't want to feel it. But if we can remember to be awake to the reality that we're not going to be hurt. In fact, it's the opposite. It's the opposite. We're going to be hurt if we're resisting. And we relax and let ourselves experience whatever it is we're experiencing, then that's freedom. That's spiritual freedom, because you don't have to hold on to the responsibility and the burden of managing your experience anymore. Whatever experience you're having is okay. It's all okay. It's all going to happen and it's going to end. And then, if you can fully open to it, then something miraculous starts to happen. It's not just that there's something in the particular experiences that's miraculous, but that if you're in this state of allowing any experience to happen, then a whole realm of connection opens up, because the contraction shuts you down and makes you not sensitive, makes you not able to actually feel what it's like to be alive as much. And it's all a question of degree, right? I mean, to the degree that contraction is there, and the contraction, of course, is changing. It's not some steady, constant thing. But to the degree that we open, we can experience the miracle. That's just a label to call it. Really, we can't put any words on it. We can't put words on what the experience of this life energy is and how it expresses itself in our hearts, you know, in our hearts as love, in our guts as body wisdom, as intuition, and in our minds as openness, as spaciousness, as consciousness. These three levels are available to us, and they respond, and they're alive, and they're communicating with us. Reality is communicating with us through our own body, isn't it? Through our own three levels. But we need to let go of the fear of what might happen if we let ourselves feel whatever we're going to feel. So, this week's Torah Parsha is Parsha Pinchas and begins with a kind of bizarre story of last week's Parsha was about the prophet Bilam, who was asked by the Moabite king Balak to come and curse the Israelites. And it's a whole story about him trying to get him to do it. And Bilam, as a prophet, says, I can only say what God wants me to say. And they try all kinds of different things. And then the climax of the story is that Bilam opens his mouth and this blessing comes out for the children of Israel. And that becomes part of our liturgy also. The Matovu prayer, Matovu ho'olecha Yaakov, Mishkan otecha Yisrael. How wonderful are your tents and your dwelling places, O Israel. Spoken by this non-Jewish prophet Bilam. And then the next episode that happens is the Moabites decide they're going to try a different tactic. Instead of trying to curse the Israelites, they're going to seduce them. And And so the Moabite women come and seduce the men somehow, and in the seduction get them to have some sort of idolatrous orgy with what's called Baal Peor, which is, I guess, the deity of the Moabites. And, you know, that's never good in the Torah when that happens. So apparently there's this incident with Zimri, an Israelite man, who gets together with Cozbi, a Midianite woman, and they get together in the actual tent of meeting, you know, in the Mishkan, in the holy place. And then Moses and Aaron are crying, you know, it's like a desecration, and then Pinchas comes and kills them both with a spear. And then in the beginning of this parsha, God gives him what's called the Brit Shalom, the covenant of peace, because he was a zealot and avenged God's vengeance. So very, yes, I'm sure we have lots of issues with this story.
Okay, so murder and having sex in the wrong place.
Sex and violence, man, that's the formula, that's the formula, right? But what I want to focus on it in a really symbolic level, you know, on a really metaphorical level, okay? Which is that, what is idolatry? The way I understand idolatry is that idolatry is when you have the trappings or the external look of a devotional relationship, right? You have it looks spiritual in a certain way on the outside because you have something greater than you that you are in relationship with. And yet, the thing that's greater than you that you're in relationship with really isn't greater than you. It's just a projection of you. It's a projection of your ego. Okay, that's how I understand idolatry. So it doesn't mean necessarily that if you have a statue that's automatically idolatry. That's the symbol of idolatry that the Torah uses. But actually, that's not the essence of it. The essence of it is that we have to know the essence of idolatry, you have to know what the essence of ego is. The essence of ego, as we've just been talking about, is resistance to what is. If you are experiencing conflict, right? I don't mean in external conflict and you're dealing with life as it unfolds. I mean like a persistent inner conflict. If you're holding conflict in yourself, in your mind, and in your heart, right? Then that's great because then you know that's what my ego is doing. That's ego. That's the definition. That's the definition that I'm using when I talk about ego. There's many different psychological definitions of ego, and people have different theories and so on. But I'm talking about a very simple thing when I use that word, and that is a contraction that happens within oneself, a contraction that is a denial or a resistance or a conflict with what is or with what we perceive to be. Right? It might not actually exist at all, but we create this, it's this contraction within ourselves, and that contraction is then something that we identify with, meaning we feel that that's me, right? So that's ego. Me, the ego, is the contracted self, and that contracted self naturally also feels less connected. It feels more separate, right, than if that contraction wasn't there and we were relaxed. In that relaxing and in that openness, there's a natural felt sense of connection with everything. And in the contractedness, there's a sense of separateness which can grow into isolation and loneliness and create all the different mental stories that come along with that. So that's what ego is. So if we're taking, if we have a god that is an idol, that means the idol is really a banner for that contraction within ourself. right? So that could, so we see that all the time with religion, right? If people are holding up their religion as the banner and then creating violence and conflict in the world, then that's idolatry, right? Because the religion is an expression of the ego. It's an expression of the ego's desire to destroy that which is in conflict with it, that it perceives to be in conflict with it anyway. And that's how it survives, right? The ego, you know, ordinary people don't go around killing people because of religion, but nevertheless, we do have egos, you know, and we do tend to feel conflict with reality and feel the suffering of that. So to bring the idolatry into the tent, the way I'm seeing it is that it means it's the tendency that we have to turn our spirituality into idolatry. And how do we do that? It's not like we're doing it on purpose. It's not like we're bad or evil or wrong or we have to be punished. But it's just a natural mistake to make. So we have to be aware of it. How do we turn spirituality into idolatry? By making some conflict out of it. Right? If your spirituality, whatever that is, meditation, you know, religious practices or whatever, if it is involved, if your involvement with it is fueling a basic conflict that you are creating in your mind, then you know it's become idolatry, it's become an idol. And to release yourself from that, to turn it back into truth, doesn't necessarily mean you have to give up the practice or change anything about it. It might mean just changing your attitude toward it. It might mean just relaxing that contraction. You know? Great example of this. I mean, because we see, you may not see this so much, but in any very religious system, you know, where people are very observant, this comes up all the time. Now, I'm not saying that therefore religious systems are bad or anything. I'm not saying that at all, because actually I think it's good that it comes up all the time, because that allows you to see it. It's good as long as you can become conscious of it and allow it to help you to grow. If your spiritual practice is just kind of casual, you're not really committed to it, then probably you're not going to make it into idolatry. You might make your vacation into idolatry, or you know, your TV show that you want to watch or whatever. That might become idolatry. But if you're very religious, if you have to have, you know, the candles lit at a certain time on Friday night, and you have to make sure that, you know, the food you're eating is a certain level, you know, then it's very easy for it to become idolatry, because it's easy to view your life and to make your life into a drama around the religious practice. It becomes a drama, which is the exact absolute polar opposite of the purpose of spirituality. Purpose of it being that you're creating a true devotional relationship with reality or with God. And that whatever practices you're taking on, you're taking them on as an act of service, as a discipline upon yourself, and a container within which to express the spiritual qualities that arise from beyond your ego. Right? So qualities such as devotion, surrender, love, wisdom, those can be embodied in a disciplined life. And then the disciplines are always reminders to be aware of ego, not be ruled by it, and allow your innate spirituality or your soul or your inner light, whatever you want to call it, to come through. So that's why we have this paradox of Pinchas doing this violent act and getting the covenant of peace. Because the violent act is, it's actually not, if you look at the story really, it's a swift killing. It's not a, he's not creating any conflict. He just goes and just destroys the idolatrous thing, the desecration of the sacred. And this is actually what the way, this is actually something that we can do within ourselves. And it's a little paradoxical because the ego's nature is to create conflict, and we're talking about being strict and, you know, stabbing, you know, killing the idolatry or something. But that one-pointedness and that decisiveness is necessary because the ego is so powerful. Or I should say, it's not that it's so powerful, it's that it's so tricky. We're actually always more powerful than it, but we can only express that power if we're not tricked by it, if we're not seduced by it, right? Seduced by it. And that's why the seduction, right? The seduction in the story. But the moment that something is triggered, the moment one of those four qualities that we've talked about are triggered, then the unconscious instant tendency is to identify with those things, identify with the anger or the greed or the you know, whatever. So to be awake enough to be able to notice it, and then kill the ego right away. Take your spear of discernment, of understanding, and just kill it right away. Now, the way you kill it, though, is not through an act of force, right? It is an act of will, but it's not an act. It's not something you have to do to your ego. It's just an awareness that it is ego. As soon as it's unmasked, right? If you unmask it within yourself, then it no longer has any power. As long as you call it out, then it's still. Then all of a sudden you can say, okay, I'm feeling this anger, this negativity, whatever, this inner pain. But you know what? Every experience is okay. I can be here with whatever experience I'm having. That's the opposite of ego. You're already free from the ego if you say that. If you say, I am deciding now that it's okay to have whatever experience that I'm having, I'm gonna let myself be here in this fire of anger, and it'll burn up for a while and then it'll subside, or I'm going to cry and I'm going to weep and I'm going to mourn, or I'm going to whatever it is, whatever the experience is, you're making a sharp decision that it's okay to have it, and therefore you're not going to be motivated by the desire to not have it, by the desire to avoid. You're not going to be motivated by avoidance. It's tricky. It's tricky. For sure it's tricky. Yeah. But that's the promise of spiritual practices. Right? If they work. Now again, they don't necessarily work. They can because they won't work if you let them become idolatry, if you let them just feed into the drama. But if you understand the root purpose of them, if you understand the dynamic at its core, which is actually fairly simple, the ego would like you to think it's more complicated. Right? Because then you have to figure it out. Wait a minute, but I, you know, maybe in this, no. It's actually very simple and absolute at its core. Life is very complicated, and how we respond to things, many options. But at its core, the spiritual work is very, very simple. It's just Pinchas with his sword. To use a much hated metaphor. So that's all for this evening.